Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We're continuing with Canto 10, Chapter 37, and we've moved on a little bit, not too much, to, let's see here, text, we're still on text 22, gosh, yeah, we'll, Krishna permitting, we'll be finishing text 22, and tomorrow morning, text 23, Canto 10, Chapter 37. Now, there was a question yesterday about, is there some reference to what Jiva Goswami mentioned about Ashta Guna, eight gunas, eight qualities. I couldn't find anything, but I could find reference to the Ashta Siddhis. Ashta Siddhis. There's eight. We discussed them a little bit. The first three, Jiva Goswami said there, that it has to do with shape or the form of the Lord or mystic yogis that have these powers. So I'll just go through them quickly. Becoming very small, like a particle, is anima siddhi, anima siddhi. Becoming very light, like a feather, lagima siddhi, and to become heavier than the heaviest, or bigger than the biggest, mahima siddhi. Those are the three siddhis in relation to the forms that the Lord manifests from time to time. There's five more. Prapti siddhi, obtaining something from a distant place or from anywhere. Prapti siddhi. Annihilate something just at will. You don't have to do even some like yajna performance and something is annihilated, just, it's a mystic power. Controlling the material elements, of course this is something that Krishna does. Vashitva siddhi. The power to have one's will not checked by anyone or anything. That's a nice power. Prakamya siddhi, and assume any form at will, is kama vasayata siddhi. So that's just a little review from yesterday, and we're continuing with this wonderful verse, text 22 of chapter 37, the verse spoken by Narada to Krishna, speaking his glories of his spiritual power that protects him from the influence of the illusory potency, which is also his potency. So we're hearing a lot about the features of Bhagavan from Bhagavat Sandarbha. This is the final section. text 58, Jiva Goswami writes, "Now that we have established that the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is different in kind from the material bodies covering the conditioned souls, we may also understand that the Lord's form is not temporary and subject to the destructive influence of time, as are earthen pots and various other objects made of inert matter, that the perfect and complete transcendental form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is eternal and not subject to the six material transformations." So this is going to spend some time on what these six are. Material, anything that's material, you know, a person's body or the universe or anything that's material that comes into being. It has transformations. Shad Vikar is the Sanskrit term, six transformations. So here they are, and we'll hear them about three times. So birth, growth, maintenance, change, dwindling, destruction. Change is, Prabhupada would say, producing byproducts. Dwindling and destruction. These six transformations are established by Lord Brahma in his prayers, Canto 10, Chapter 14, Text 23. "My conclusion is, therefore, that you are the Supreme Soul, Absolute Truth, and the Supreme Original Person. Although you have expanded yourself in so many Vishnu forms," which Brahma saw, the expansion of so many Vishnu forms, "or in living entities and energies," because he saw all of that also, "by your inconceivable potencies, you are the Supreme One without a second. You are the source of the original Brahma Jyoti. Indeed, the Brahma Jyoti is nothing but your personal bodily effulgence. Your body is eternal, indestructible, and full of bliss. You are also Niranjana because your pastimes, as the little son of your mother Yashoda, or the Lord of the Gopis, are never contaminated by material qualities. You are always complete, one without a second, and you are transcendental to both nescience and knowledge. Thus, you are the original Amrita, the indestructible nectar of immortality." So that was verse 23, meant to establish the fact that the personality of Godhead, Krishna's form, is beyond the six changes. Back, and then he refers to the first verse of that chapter, which is chapter 14. Brahma explained that the form of Sri Krishna, who has a dark complexion, the color of a rain cloud, is the most worthy object of praise. We shall now demonstrate that Sri Krishna is the supreme object of praise and that he is the super soul present in all living entities and the supreme shelter of everyone. That Krishna is the shelter of everyone and everything and the super soul present in the hearts of all living entities is confirmed by the following statements, plural statements of Lord Brahma. So he refers to two verses from chapter 14 again. These are Brahma's prayers. These are important prayers. Starting with chapter, text 18 from chapter 14. "My dear Lord, leaving aside all other things and just considering today's happenings, what I have seen, are they not all due to your inconceivable energies? First of all, I saw you alone. Thereafter, you expanded yourself as your friends, the calves, and all the existence of Vrindavan. Then I saw you and the cowherd boys as four-headed Vishnus, and they were being worshipped by all the elements and demigods, including myself. Again, they were all wound up, and you remained alone, as you were before. Does this not mean that you are the Supreme Lord, Narayana, the origin of everything, and from you everything emanates, and again everything enters into you, and you remain the same as before? That's a pretty good verse, huh? Text 18. And towards the end of the chapter, text 55, you should know Krishna as the original soul of all atmas, or living entities. For the benefit of the whole universe, he has, out of his causeless mercy, appeared as an ordinary human being. He has done this with the strength of his own internal potency. So referring to this text, both texts, in this verse, Srila Shukadeva Goswami intends to say, O Krishna, because you are the super soul present in the hearts of all living entities, it should be understood that you are eternal. And because you are the ultimate shelter of upon which everything rests, whatever is eternal is so because of your eternality. You are the original abode of all eternality. Then he goes back to the prayers of the demigods, chapter 2, canto 10. That Sri Krishna is the resting place of all immortality is confirmed by the demigods, who offer the following prayer to Sri Krishna. So, chapter 2, text 26 reads, O Lord, you never deviate from your vow, which is always perfect because whatever you decide is perfectly correct and cannot be stopped by anyone. Being present in the three phases of cosmic manifestation, namely creation, maintenance, and annihilation, you are the supreme truth. Indeed, unless one is completely truthful, one cannot achieve your favor, which therefore cannot be achieved by hypocrites. You are the active principle, the real truth in all the ingredients of creation, and therefore you are known as Antaryami, the inner force. You are equal to everyone, and your instructions apply for everyone for all time. You are the beginning of all truth. Therefore, offering our obeisances, we surrender unto you, kindly give us protection. Which was also in text 22. Narada's first line is requesting protection. Commentary continues that Sri Krishna is the original source of all eternality is also confirmed by the following statement of Mahabharata. Quote, all eternality is situated within the Supreme Eternal Lord Krishna. Pretty straightforward. Because all eternality has its source in him, he is therefore known by the name Satya, the eternal. Now he goes to the sixth transformation, the Shad Vikar, one more time. That Sri Krishna is completely free from the material transformations, birth, growth, maintenance, change, dwindling, and destruction, is confirmed by Lord Brahma in his prayer number 23. We touched on that one already, 23. O my Lord, you are the origin of everything. Adhyaha. You are the origin of everything. So there's, that's, Jiva Goswami is saying, that's indicating there's no transformation in him. That is to say, things that transform come from him who is not transformed, because he's the source of everything. Brahma's statement in text 18 of this chapter 14 also confirms that Lord Krishna never undergoes transformation known as birth. So that's the first on the list of six. He doesn't undergo the transformation of birth. That Lord Krishna is never actually born is confirmed in Padma Purana. Quote, although Lord Hari appears before the eyes of his devotees, he never undergoes the material transformation known as birth. And Skanda Purana also indicates, fools do not understand the truth about the blissful, eternal, and unchanging Supreme Personality of Godhead, the cause of all causes. They mistakenly think that the Supreme Lord has taken birth in a material body composed of the five elements. He actually never takes birth. And the eternal existence is confirmed in text 23 of Canto 10, chapter 14, Brahma again. O Lord, you are the oldest, the original person, Purusha Purnaha. From this we may understand that Lord Krishna always existed. He existed. This is about there's no birth. He always existed. He existed before the creation of the material world in an eternally youthful body. Although he is the oldest, he remains eternally youthful. That the Supreme Personality of Godhead existed before the creation of the material universes is confirmed in Brihat Aranyaka Upanishad, which says, the Supreme Personality of Godhead existed before the creation of the material universes. So that's no birth, because creation and things are born, but he existed before that, or eternally. Next, that's the first of the six changes, and next is maintenance. The second material transformation is maintenance, that Sri Krishna is free from any considerations of maintenance is confirmed. Again, he refers to text 23 of Brahma's prayers. O Lord, you are always perfect and complete. So, no maintenance. Because Lord Krishna is always perfect, he never grows. That's the third transformation. The fourth material transformation is change. Brahma confirms that Sri Krishna is free from change in the following words from the same text he's been referring to over and over. O Lord Krishna, you are eternally full of all transcendental bliss. So let's see what the connection is between being full of bliss and no change. Because Lord Krishna is always blissful, his condition of life never changes. That the Supreme Personality of Godhead is full of bliss is also confirmed in the following statement of Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad, which says, the Supreme Godhead is full of all knowledge and bliss. So let's go back over that again. If he's full of bliss, then there's no change. The logic of that statement is going to come shortly. But why does something change? Because we're not happy. So we want to go from this to that because it's a material calculation or material hankering for happiness, and it brings about change. There's always perpetually not satisfaction. And because of that not satisfaction, there's desire for satisfaction or striving for something that is supposed to bring satisfaction. But when one is filled with bliss, there's no need for anything. No change. Number five of these changes is dwindling. Brahma confirms that Sri Krishna is free from dwindling. The same verse from chapter 14. Oh, Lord Krishna, you are eternally free from decay and diminution. Akshaya. Six is destruction, and that's the last of the six. And he goes, I'm going to go through the list again. Brahma confirms that Sri Krishna is free from destruction in the following words. Same Bhagavatam verse. O Lord Krishna, you are never to be destroyed. You are eternal, Amrita. Lord Krishna's perfection and completeness are described by Brahma in the following words from the same Bhagavatam verse. O Lord Krishna, you are unlimited and one without a second. Unlimited, Ananta, and one without a second, Advaya. This means that Sri Krishna is beyond all limitations of time, space, and size, and nothing can exist without the manifestation of his potencies. So now we're going back to birth. In order to prove that Sri Krishna is eternal, Brahma explains that Sri Krishna is beyond the four kinds of results. Results, birth, attainment of ends, change, purification, which follow the actions of the conditioned souls. That Sri Krishna is not born, again, this is the first change or first result, birth. Brahma explains by the statement, Oh, Lord Krishna, you are the origin of everything. There is no birth. So he's going to this list of four. This is results, four kinds of results from actions of conditioned souls. We do things. So we bring things into being. But for the personality of Godhead, he is the origin of everything. So it's not just bring things into being, but birth. That's an action. His has no birth. The second result of work, attainment of some ends, which may be done either with physical endeavor or as a result of knowledge. Sri Krishna does not need to endeavor physically to attain any end. For as Brahma says, he's the all-pervading super soul, Atma. And at the same time, Krishna does not need to undergo meditation or mental speculation to attain some end, as the impersonal philosopher does, because he is himself the origin of the Brahma Jyoti, Swayam Jyoti, as Brahma says. So these are results of work or activity in this world. These are transformations. So you bring something about. So there's no birth. Attaining some end for Krishna. There's no attaining some end because everything comes from him. He doesn't attain anything. It's him or his. The third result of work is change. That was already discussed, but here it is again. Sri Krishna is free from change because, as Brahma says here, quote, he never accepts a changing material body, upadito mukta. We discussed upadis yesterday. Remember? Huh? Okay. You remember? A little bit? Huh?
I'm not able to remember from yesterday.
Okay. You know what upadi means? You've heard the word before, right? Sarva upadi vinirmuktam tat paratvena nirmalam. Upadi, the way that we're used to hearing it in ISKCON means designation, like American Indian or man, woman, or tall or short, or this species, that species. It's an upadhi. It's a designation. So the impersonalists use the word upadhi in a slightly different way. There's Brahman, and that's reality, and then other things are just upadhis superimposed upon Brahman. So they say Krishna's form is an upadhi. Or anything, because all there is Brahman. That's like rock bottom. So anything, you name it, it's just a superimposition upon Brahman. So Krishna's form is an upadhi. So Brahma says he never accepts a changing material body, or upadito mukta. No change. Because upadhis are things material change always. Like the weather. Can't make up its mind. It's going to be whatever it's going to be. So it's always changing. Then so that's a result of work, is change, a material work. So for Krishna, there's no material work because he has no changing material body, because those are upadhis and that's not him. The fourth result of work is purification. Sri Krishna is never need of purification because, as Brahma says, he is always free from all contamination, Niranjana. In this way, Sri Krishna remains aloof from the four kinds of results of work. The next topic, that Sri Krishna and his transcendental abode may be directly perceived by the devotees, is explained in the following statement of Srimad Bhagavatam. So though it's not material, Krishna's form and Krishna's abode may be perceived by the devotee, explained in the following statement, 2.9.22. That's the 2.9.22 is chapter 9, is Brahma coming to the stage of perfection, and then he sees Vishnu in the Chaturshloki verses towards the end of chapter 9 of Canto 2. This is text 22 from that same section, where the Supreme Lord says to Lord Brahma, quote, "The highest perfectional ingenuity is the personal perception of my abodes. And this has been possible because of your submissive attitude in the performance of severe penance according to my order." So he gave order, tapa, he did the tapa, then the Lord is speaking to him. He's going to show his abode. And this is the highest thing that's being awarded by the personality of Godhead. Sridhar Swami comments on this verse, 2.9.22. In this verse, Lord Krishna says to Brahma, "By my mercy, you are able to see this," his abode. "Because I wish it, you may now directly perceive this," Mani Sitta. One may ask, why is it that Brahma is able to see by the Lord's mercy? The answer is given. You are now able to see my own abode, Mama Loka Valokayanyat, that the Supreme Personality of Godhead reveals himself to his devotees is also confirmed. So it's that which is not material can be seen when the Lord makes that which is not material visible. And he does that when there's a sincere devotee, then he shows himself, I'm like this. confirmed in the Narayana Adhyatmam, Adhyatmya. Translation reads, although the Supreme Personality Godhead generally remains invisible, he may nevertheless be seen through the agency of his own transcendental potency. Someone may object. And then he answers the objection. It is not so. Oh, is it not so that in the description of his opulences in Srimad Bhagavatam, 11.16.29, the Personality of Godhead said, quote, among exalted persons, Bhagavan, I appear as the son of Maharaj Vasudev. It is said, among exalted persons, Bhagavan, I appear as the son of Maharaj Vasudev. Is it not also said that at the end of this description of his opulence, the Supreme Lord says, quote, these opulences of mine are all transformations of the mind. He says that. Clearly, the objection Percy may say, from this we may understand that the form of Lord Krishna, son of Vasudeva, is not the original personality of Godhead, but rather the expansion of one of his opulences. Furthermore, does not the second quote establish the truth that the form of Lord Krishna and the other opulences of the Absolute Truth described in this passage are not transcendental forms, but merely transformations of the material thinking process? He's tackling, you know, the objection. Historically, when we had the appearance day of Jiva Goswami not so long ago. So one of the things that happened in his childhood or youth is after meeting Lord Nityananda, he sent him to Prayag to study under Madhusudana Vachaspati, who taught him the six atheistic doctrines, so that he would know what they say, and he would know how to refute what they say. Because Madhusudana Vachaspati also was a great devotee of Lord Chaitanya. He knew Lord Chaitanya's teachings. So a juxtaposition of these two things. So here, Jiva Goswami knows what those atheistic persons view the scripture. They knows how they interpret the scripture, so he's presenting one of these interpretations, and that is the form of the Lord is just an imposition on the mind. There's another upadhi. The form of the Lord is nothing but an imposition on the mind, which is always changing because the mind is always changing and transforming. And the material thinking process is that source which generates this idea and even vision of the form of the Lord. That's all it is. So Jiva Goswami is saying, I'll take it on. To this objection I reply, my dear friend, these quotes are very nice, of course, but just as the sentence Chatrino Gachanti is ambiguous and requires some explanation before it is properly understood, in the same way, these verses of Srimad Bhagavatam require an elaborate explanation before they are properly understood. So now, I don't know what this Chatrino Gachanti meant, so I looked it up. And it's a classic, one of the classics in the Vedic text is when you see, you know, the fallibility of reason and logic is when you see, in a distance you see smoke what looks like smoke on a mountain, it means there's fire. But that sense perception could be, you know, wrongly interpreted. So the senses are imperfect. That's the classic example. That's one. So it could be there, the fire on the other side, the wind blew it, now the fire's over. So there isn't a fire on the mountain, or it could be just a cloud, or it could be some other thing. So sense perception is inadequate. The combining sense perception and reason. So that's a classic. So this is similarly, this is a classic. And the classic is, how to read Sanskrit literature. The English word is hermeneutics, but it's like how you read a text from scripture. If it's just, it doesn't make sense, you have to take an indirect meaning. You have to consider it carefully. If it's, you don't necessarily have to take the literal meaning. So this is an example of one of those. You must take a figurative meaning or an indirect meaning. So here's just cutting and pasting. Here, this Chatrino Gachanti literally is translated, the students are going. So the word Chatrinaha figuratively refers to a crowd of people, presumably primarily made up of students. Because of the impossibility of everyone in a crowd being a student. And so I found that in a writing of Kavi Karnapur, who is explaining how to understand scripture, and he refers to this Chatrino Gachanti, which apparently is not just Kavi Karnapur's example, but a standard example of teaching people how to read Sanskrit properly. So Kavi Karnapur explains, there's a necessity of accepting a figurative meaning of a word when the literal meaning just does not make sense. So the word, that the term that he's using in his writing is lakshana. What does lakshana mean? It means characteristic of something. So lakshana is, in literature, it's the mode of meaning which causes the understanding of another meaning connected with the literal meaning when the literal meaning doesn't make sense. So it's an ornament of literature when something is said that's just using a metaphor that isn't really a literal meaning, but it's a metaphorical meaning. And so the figurative meaning, it makes it beautiful. So he's using this Chatrino Gachanti, which apparently is a standard example of how to read Sanskrit literature. You have to look carefully when it just doesn't make sense. And then you're obliged to take the secondary or an indirect meaning. So he's saying, these nice references, my dear friend, they sound very nice, but it has to be looked at in the same way that this Chatrino Gachanti phrase, which is ambiguous and requires some explanation. So here's his explanation. In this connection, we may note the use of the word param. We know what param means. It means transcendental. We may note the use of the word param in the following verse from the same section of Srimad Bhagavatam. 11:16-37. This is Uddhava Gita. Where Lord Krishna says, quote, I am form, taste, aroma, touch, and sound, false ego, the mahatattva, earth, water, fire, air, and the sky, the living entity, material nature, the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance, all these items, along with knowledge of their individual symptoms, and the steady conviction that results from this knowledge, represents me. We may note that in this verse, the word param refers to the absolute truth. According to this interpretation, then, the Supreme Brahman is counted among the opulences of the Lord. Which are further described as, from another verse from this Uddhava Gita section, transformations of the mind. Such an explanation of the nature of Brahman will clearly not satisfy those who are aware of the actual meaning of Vedic literatures. Brahman is not a material transformation. So we have to take a look at what the literal transformation, literal meaning says. And we have to look at it as a secondary meaning, because Brahman isn't just a material transformation by definition. Brahman is free from any material covering, this upadi. So Krishna is also, Krishna's form is free from upadis. So Brahman is free from any material covering or material external form, just as a threshed grain of rice is free from the external husk. This transcendental nature of Brahman is explained by the following statements. There's many from the scriptures. Same 10:14:23. Oh, Supreme Lord, you are free from material coverings. Or, hey, here's our verse, 10:37:22. I offer my respectful obeisances to the Supreme Lord, whose form is full of the purest transcendental knowledge. Full of the purest transcendental knowledge means there's no ignorance covering. There's no covering. One such statement, now this is this statement that's needs interpretation or needs a secondary meaning. This is an example of such a statement spoken by Bhishmadev, 1:9:34. He's going to speak of Krishna's body being pierced by arrows. On the battlefield where Sri Krishna attended Arjuna out of friendship, the flowing hair of the Lord turned ashen due to the dust raised by the hooves of the horses, and because of his labor, beads of sweat wetted his face. All these descriptions, intensified by the wounds dealt by my sharp arrows, were enjoyed by him. Let my mind thus go unto Sri Krishna. Nice verse. He explains, because the transcendental body of Krishna can never be hurt or pierced by any weapon, it should be understood that the description of this pastime should not be taken as truth in its literal sense, but as a specific illusion arranged by the Lord. Another example of a statement contrary to the truth, but yet given in Srimad Bhagavatam, is mentioned in the following statement of Shukadeva Goswami in connection with Krishna's lamentation during his battle with Shalva. In his battle with Shalva, things happened. Shalva had mystic powers, and Krishna became bewildered and felt horrified because Shalva showed this person cut off Vasudeva's head right in front of him, his father's head. This is just outside Dwarka. O King Parikshit, although Krishna lamented when Shalva attempted to trick him into thinking that his father Vasudeva was killed, we should understand that in actuality, Lord Krishna was not at all fooled, and he did not lament. Although some sages may say that the Lord lamented, such statements are not fit to be accepted as truth. Circling back again. So he's now putting to rest this argument that says the form of the Lord is just an appearance of something in the mind. That the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is spiritual and free from all material defects is also confirmed in the following statement of Skanda Purana, quote, Lord Vishnu is completely aloof from the influence of material energy. He is eternal, imperishable, unbreakable, undefeatable, and undecaying. He appears in this world and enjoys pastimes with his devotees. He pretends to be an ordinary human being. And in this role, he may sometimes appear to be bound with ropes or to bleed when wounded. Although these activities bewilder the demons, the liberated souls do not become bewildered. They always understand the actual nature of the Lord. Back to Bhishma Dev again. As he was fighting with Krishna, Bhishma Dev became momentarily overwhelmed by a demonic thought of harming Krishna. And in this way, he became bewildered into thinking that Krishna had been wounded. Later, Bhishma remembered that bewilderment as one remembers a painful nightmare. And he expressed that memory in the verse quoted previously. Almost done. Another doubt. Someone may ask, how is it that Lord Krishna became so pure and free from material contamination that he could not be wounded or bleed? He didn't become, but the question is, how did he become? Did he come under the influence of some wonderful purifying substance, or did he assiduously rid himself of all impurities? In answer to this question, I explain, Krishna is eternally pure and does not require to do something to become free from contamination. He did not require to come under the influence of some purifying agent because he himself is perfect and complete, and therefore everything that purifies is already present within him. In this same way, he does not require to rid himself of impurities, since impurities can never enter him, as Lord Brahma explains, same 10.14.23. Quote, oh, Lord Krishna, you are always free from all kinds of material contamination, Niranjana. In this way, it may be understood that the form of Sri Krishna is always uncontaminated and full of pure transcendental knowledge. That's the end of that verse 22. Yay! Our celebrated verse is now. Moving on to the next text 23 for tomorrow. So what's a nice big broad summary of all of what we've been doing here? The introductory verses, Satyam Param Dhimahi, declares that the Bhagavatam is Dhimahi, is a meditation upon the original absolute truth. And so this is expanding that meditation on the original absolute truth. And Bhagavan feature is the resting place of the Paramatma, and Brahman feature of the Supreme. He's all those things, but he's the rest and basis of all those things. And included in all those things are his pastimes, and his pastimes going back to these, you know, six changes and products of work. There's nothing that he needs to achieve or produce. It's literally pastimes. That is to say, he could have some person, or he could have a Vishnu expansion. So when he comes himself, it's just a pastime. And this happens, that happens by the agency of his potencies. But it's not like someone that has a material covering doing something. Mistakenly, some persons think that's what the case is. All there is Brahman, and then there's these things stuck on upadis, stuck on Brahman. And so Krishna does things, but that's how we look at them. No. He is the personality of Godhead with spiritual form, rupam, svayam rupa, and he has potencies that are inherent within that form. And through those potencies, he does things. But it's not, you know, to achieve something. It's literally just pastime. And the pastime has its purpose of attracting the hearts and the minds of the devotees to him. Depending upon their regard for him, they'll see him in different ways. He's attracting their hearts and their minds to him through his pastimes, which are none different than him, and that the pastimes are as transcendental as he is. So we're just getting a nice picture that helps us understand Krishna, his form, his qualities, his pastimes, his entourage, meaning his devotees and his relationships with them. Just elevating consciousness to the transcendental platform by explaining and referencing. Okay. Well, we have a shrunken group this morning. Let's see if there's some discussion. Or online. Yes, she has something.
Hare Krishna, Guru Maharaj. So, what we discussed about Krishna doesn't take birth, and as a devotee and as we have been listening that he has a form, we have a faith, but some people, they don't have faith in that.
Yes.
And they don't want to accept and they don't trust scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
So how one can
help those people move?
Develop that faith with the association or natural?
Well, I'm thinking of this example that Prabhupada gives. You know, how do you get somebody to see light if they want to stay in darkness? I just heard him describing this a few days back. They're locked up in a room, no windows, and the door is closed, and they're in darkness. And you want them to see light, and they don't want to see light. So you can't force people, but by description, you may say there's a place that has, this is a classic actual example. Greek philosophy, the cave analogy. You've heard of that one? Plato's cave analogy. Somebody's born in a cave and never saw light, somebody comes in from outside and says, hey, there's light. Well, what's that? Is it the same as, you know, a fire here? No. It's, you know, so they have no frame of reference. But, you know, so how do you describe something to somebody that has no frame of reference and they're not really even interested? They have no faith in that there's such a thing as other than the cave, the place of darkness, and some kind of artificial light. So, it's through sound. And even if the person doesn't have faith that sound is light, or gives illumination, because the sound that's representing Krishna has illumination, and it has some effect. So you don't want to cross over, you know, the relationship and have them just like reject the relationship or start making offenses or something. But if there's some willingness to hear, that's the beginning. Supposing, a nice example that comes to mind is Prabhupada explaining how he began the Hare Krishna movement through kirtan. And he said, you know, people may understand, they may not understand, they may appreciate, they may not appreciate, but it's the sound vibration is creating auspiciousness. So some people like music and you offer some music. It depends on, so it says that the primary medium is sound, and however people can receive it in a, even if it's unfavorable, but you receive it in a favorable way is better, then it'll have some effect. Faith is created in association with those who have faith. That's how faith is created. It's or awakened. So somehow, you know, with people that don't have faith, somehow just being, you know, a wholesome person may have them have a little faith in what it is that you're up to, that this makes you, you know, this makes her a wholesome person. That's, you know, there's different things that can stir faith. But it's sound and association primarily.
And I don't know this again. Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu, Krishna. So Krishna is unborn. How about Brahma? Does he take? I mean, I know
he takes birth. Yes, Brahma takes birth.
And he grows.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And similar.
He's empowered. Shiva. He's in charge of one of the gunas. But he takes birth and he departs.
Shiva?
Huh?
Shiva does too?
Shiva is very puzzling. He is not eternal. There's a tattva, but the tattva manifests likened to milk touched by a souring agent becomes curd or dahi. And so you have to have some souring agent. So Shiva manifests. Let's say when the universe is destroyed, Shiva's abode is also gone. But it's a little complicated. Shiva tattva is very complicated because he has different manifestations. There's like six of them. And some of them are temporary and some of them are not. Most of them are temporary. And so the Shiva that everybody worships is temporary. He appears and then he and his abode are gone. When the universe is withdrawn, he and the universe is withdrawn. his abode. However, there are features or aspects of Lord Shiva that are not created and not destroyed. In Shiva Loka and in Sadashiva, in the Vaikuntha realm. It's a little complex. So it's an involved topic. But so a short answer is yes, destroyed. But at more involved is there are aspects of Lord Shiva that are not created or destroyed. Anything that's created is destroyed. Okay. There's if you're interested, maybe you can find the recording of discussing. It was a topic that Vibhu Chaitanya wanted me to discuss at one point in time. Shiva, because lots of people in his Bhakti Bhikshu groups out there, it was like, hey, what's going on? So there's a whole presentation on that topic, and then you may want to take a look at it. There's images that show this and that, this and that. It's complicated. But in short, there are aspects of Lord Shiva that are temporary. There's aspects of Lord Shiva that are not. He's in his own tattva. Vishnu tattva is not the same as Shiva tattva. Okay. Anything?
This question is from Amrita Keli Mataji. We hear the examples of devotees well versed in other doctrines. In Srimad Bhagavatam 117 purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, one can sit on the Vyasasana only after being conversant in all systems of philosophy, so that one can present fully the theistic views of the Bhagavatam in defiance of all other systems. On the other hand, we know Lord Chaitanya's instruction for the devotees not to hear from Mayavadis. How do we understand this and how do we apply this in our practical lives?
Well, when Chaitanya Charitamrita was being translated by Srila Prabhupada, when it came to chapter 7 of Adi Lila, he made a big deal about it. It's Lord Chaitanya's discussions with Prakashananda Saraswati, and he had it published as a separate volume in hardcover, separate volume softcover. He made a big deal about it because it was, what's the word? Anesthetizing. Is that the right word? Not anesthetize. Inoculating us against Mayavad philosophy. So it was, here's Prakashananda Saraswati, and here's Lord Chaitanya's response, and here's what our acharyas say about what Prakashananda Saraswati said. So we were being inoculated, although we hadn't encountered those ideologies. So it was, he wanted us to become conversant. So it's not just what the Mayavadis say, and if that's all you hear is what the Mayavadis say in their arguments, then Lord Chaitanya advised against that. But getting a clear understanding of what Mayavadis say or the other atheistic doctrines say, like karma mimamsa philosophy, is right there in Krishna book when Krishna spoke to his father. So what do such people say? And what's the refutation of that idea? So that's to be encouraged. At least at a certain stage of spiritual development. Because otherwise you'll hear and be bewildered if you don't know what it is that they're saying and what's the refutation.
This question is from Amara Mataji. Here the reference is Narada Muni is requesting Krishna to go to Mathura and other places to mitigate the fears of those residents. And last few days we had also discussed his energies, Krishna's energies. Can you kindly help me understand what is the reason for discussing Krishna's transcendental nature? Kindly forgive me for missing that link.
I'm not sure what the question is. Why discuss Krishna's transcendental nature is your question?
The question is, what is the link about this topic to the original topic of Narada Muni is asking Krishna to go to Mathura?
Trying to understand what her question is. Well, there's two links. I mean, I think I understand her question. The two links that seems to be responsive to her question is the very first line of what Narada says is, "Let us take shelter unto you, the Supreme Personality of Godhead." So he's the voice of those who aren't Brijvasis. We're depending upon you, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who has all powers and so forth, to give us protection. We take shelter of you. So I and others outside of Vrindavan are depending upon you for protection, please. And you've made a pledge to the demigods, so please fulfill your pledge to the demigods. And his divinity is what gives protection. He's protected, and where those who get his association, they're protected. So he's referring to his opulences, his Bhagavan features, his spiritual potencies. So in this way, you're not contaminated, and they will become free from any material influences also. So please go.
So this question is from Uttama Bhakta Prabhu. Janma Karma Chame Divyam verse indicates that Lord's appearance. Janma Karma Chame Divyam verse indicates Lord's appearance and pastimes. When Lord shows blood in the battlefield, or leaving his body behind at the end of his pastimes, is just Lord Yogeshwara's feature? Is it just Lord Yogeshwara's feature?
Is it Lord Yogeshwara doing what?
Is it just Lord's Yogeshwara feature doing this?
Feature. I don't know if you need to narrow it down to just Yogeshwara feature. He's definitely showing opulences, but it seems more as Yogamaya, as a deluding, covering his true identity feature, not Yogeshwara feature, but a Yogamaya feature. So worldly people are bewildered when they see or hear.
And this question is from Urja Mataji. Generally, I've heard from you that direct or primary meanings taken related to Lord Krishna by the acharyas in the scriptures. But are there any reasons here the secondary or indirect meanings also are considered?
We just heard it. The answer is yes. And Jiva Goswami is giving examples. So yes, there are circumstances.
And this question is from Hema Mataji. Hema Suryavanshi Mataji. As you described about the importance of sound, so how should I hear the sound vibration so it goes deep in my heart and change my consciousness?
Open your heart. Hear from your heart, not just the mind. That's how. And you have to, like, what does that mean? You know the difference because one is transforming and the other is not. So how do you hear from the heart? You let the sound, you're submissive, and with faith, that's, you want to receive mercy from Krishna, that's hearing from the heart. Okay? Oh, one more? Okay.
This is from Gopi Priya, Shyamasundara Prabhu and Harikatha Mataji's daughter. Little off topic. Why did Lord Vishnu appear before Daksha, although his heart is not pure and we know that he curses Narada Muni?
Because he's giving his mercy. He doesn't need a cause. He's merciful.